Thank you for your blessing. I'll start with a disclaimer. I'm not feeling 100% my best. I've been struggling with a form of bronchitis for about 2 months now, and I'm still not quite over it. But I did everything I could in terms of resting it so that I could be available to be here with you today. And we'll see how effective your blessing is, see if I can get through our time together. I think it may have been about 3 years ago, I gave a presentation here on the soul journey. And during that presentation, I shared some of my own experiences. And I ended up sharing an experience I had as I was telling you about Beatrice Bruteau's idea of disidentification. And as I read her work on disidentification, I went through her exercise. And the exercise would be very much like disidentifying with everything that Anne just spoke about. Thank you. A cup of cold water is greatly appreciated. As I did that exercise, which was fascinating, I ended up with, well, how would I define myself if I am not going to use my descriptors to identify myself? What is left? And I remember sharing with you at that time, for those of you who were here, that what I ended up with was, I am one with the one who is. And I concluded that I was comfortable with that identification. But even then I wondered, will this continue to evolve? Well, I'm here this morning to tell you that it has indeed continued to evolve. And now I am convinced that it will also, that my new definition will also continue to evolve. So at the end of my presentation this morning, I will give you my new self-definition, but you have to stay till the end to hear it. Companions who've guided me on my journey are Ilya Delio, Cynthia Bourgeau, Beatrice Bruteau, Teilhard de Chardin, Father Thomas Keating, Thomas Merton, Richard Rohr. A good mixture of men and women. But you know, as I continue to grow in age and wisdom, I have become aware of how important it is for me to read women mystics and women theologians. They give me a richer and broader understanding of unity consciousness and heart consciousness. I wonder perhaps if it's because they're not so entangled in patriarchy. I call the presentation today the discipline of spiritual practice, because spiritual practice is so much more than just attending a class in yoga or awareness meditation or centering prayer. The most important part of spiritual practice is fidelity to one's chosen practice. I think there has been a tendency for many people to begin a practice, stay with it for a year or two, and then when the hard time comes, the boring times, whatever, try another one. Let's see if I can go to this one. That is not the process of transformation. The process of transformation is to select a spiritual practice that selects you in many ways, if you listen deeply, and through thick and thin, stick with the practice. Now, in our book that we're reading, John Philip Newell refers to the Christian mystic Thomas Merton as an example of someone who was faithful and trained his inner vision to remain alert to the glory that is at the heart of every moment. In this chapter, we read that Merton said, "We are living in a world that is absolutely transparent. And God is shining through this world at all times, in people, in things, in nature, and in events. But the problem is, we don't see it." So Merton says, spiritual practice is about remembering to see. It's about intentional disciplines, individually and collectively, that will enable us to be more aware of the shinings of divine presence that are within us and all around us. Fidelity to a chosen practice will invite us to understand our God differently, but also our sense of self, differently. It's interesting, isn't it, that as you read the early mystics, this idea of getting to know God always involves getting to know self as well. We can't separate the two. Now, Merton posits a threefold pattern to spiritual practice. He says, one, spiritual practice is about remembering our diamond essence. Two, spiritual practice is about remembering that the diamond essence is at the heart of each one of us and at the heart of all things. And three, we will find true strength for the holy work of transformation in the world only by digging deep into the foundations of our own being. So in this presentation, I'll be touching on each of these patterns, but perhaps in a different order or perhaps more intermingled. So let's go to our modern physics. We know that today modern physics points to intrinsic relationality at the heart of life. And today scientists are suggesting that matters are not composed of building blocks, but rather they're composed of complicated webs of energy relations. So today we believe that interconnectedness lies at the core of all that exists. Interconnectedness lies at the core of all that exists. Beatrice Brutault speaks of a metaphysics of communion. And by this, she means that relationship is a basic principle of life. Metaphysics of communion. Think about that. God is relationship. Matter is relationship, and human life is relationship. Which means that we need a new philosophical understanding of nature that begins with relationality. A metaphysics of communion based on intrinsic relationality undergirds a new understanding of the human person. So how are we today to understand the human person in the framework of a metaphysics of communion? Well, Brutault distinguishes between an individual and a person. And she says that an individual is an individuated existent with a lexicon less complexified consciousness of others. Lots of words. An individuated existent, a person who sees him or herself as an individual with a much less complexified consciousness of others. Another way of saying that is a person who does not necessarily have in their awareness the other. Whereas a person is one who has a higher level of an other-centered consciousness. Her conclusion is that only persons can enter into communion consciousness. Individuals remain external to one another. Anne mentioned that I had become a certified transactional analyst. And I remember I was living out here in California, but I went home to visit. And I was telling my mother all about transactional analysis and blah, 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 on and on. And finally she stopped me and she says, "You know, Suzanne, this sounds so self-centered. It sounds like it's all about an individual, just about you. Where's the other in this?" I was thinking of that as I was writing this and saying, "Rita, you have wisdom to spare." It is this transcendence of the person over the individual that makes possible the communion consciousness of the new creation in Christ. Let me say that once again. It is the transcendence of the person over the individual that makes possible communion consciousness of the new creation in Christ. Reality is being with another in a way that is open to more union and more being. Think of the example that Newell gives in this chapter of Thomas's experience in Louisville, Kentucky. His boundaries collapsed, and he was suddenly overwhelmed by the realization that he loved everyone around him, that they were mine, quote, and I theirs, that we could not be alien to one another, even though we were total strangers. It was like waking from a dream of separateness, end of quote. Building on Teilhard de Chardin's primacy of love energy, Brutteaux writes that a person is not an individuated being. Rather, a person is the unbounded activity of freely projecting energies of what she calls spondic energy, S-P-O-N-D-I-C. And she defines spondic as a Greek word that means libation. But I love the word. It's new, it's different. And she describes it as the unbounded activity of freely projecting energies. It does not originate out of thought, and it does not originate out of will. But spondic energy comes from a deep, transcendent center, the still point within our beings where we are held by Omega. Spondic energy originates spontaneously, arising only from itself. It is always free. In this way of becoming, I do not exist in order that I may possess. Rather, I exist that I may give of myself. For it is truly in giving that I am most myself. So this differentiated self-gift of personhood arises out of a deep center within, where humanity is held by divinity in utter silence, and freedom. When we affirm another person with our own spandic energy, it is the personal being of the other that is being affirmed. The central selfhood, or the personal omega center, so to speak. To affirm another from this spandic energy place, we need not sanction the person's behavior, especially if it is harmful or evil. We do not need to like the person in the sense of personality or emotional attraction. All these belong to the individual, not the person. The person transcends the individual's qualities, and the person is spandic energy, fresh every moment, having no past, utterly spontaneous, and capable of new manifestations. So this has been a lot of words. And for some of you, maybe some of these words are all new and put together. So I've asked Joanna Williams to read a story from Scripture for us that will help to illustrate this concept of spandic energy. So I think, Joanna, you'll have to use that microphone.
How's that?
I think we're good. You're going to hold it like that, all right? I'm going to pull this up.
This is the story of Zacchaeus.
Get closer to the mic.
The story of Zacchaeus from the Gospel of Luke. Entering Jericho, Jesus passed through the city. There was a wealthy person there named Zacchaeus, the chief tax collector. Zacchaeus was trying to see who Jesus was, but he could not do so because of the crowd, since he was short. In order to see Jesus, Zacchaeus ran on ahead, then climbed a sycamore tree that was along the route. When Jesus came to the spot, he looked up and said, "Zacchaeus, hurry and come down. I am going to stay at your house today." Zacchaeus quickly climbed down and welcomed Jesus with delight. When everyone saw this, they began to grumble. "Jesus has gone to a sinner's house as a guest." Zacchaeus stood his ground and said to Jesus, "Here and now I give half my belongings to poor people. If I have defrauded anyone in the least, I will pay them back fourfold." Jesus said to the tax collector, "Today salvation has come to this house. For this is what it means to be a descendant of Sarah and Abraham. The promised one has come to search out and save what was lost."
Thank you, Joanna. So there's a couple of things I'd like you to note from this story that you read so well for us. One is to note how the crowd perceived Zacchaeus, and then to note how Jesus perceived Zacchaeus. The crowd saw his identity, and perhaps only his identity. He was a tax collector, a fraud, a cheater, a sinner. But Jesus saw his personhood, a good man, generous, and honest. He saw Zacchaeus' spondic energy, fresh every moment, having no past, utterly spontaneous, and capable of a new manifestations. By seeing Zacchaeus with his own spontaneous energy, Jesus was able to call out to Zacchaeus' spondic energy. And you see the results. Hence and now, Zacchaeus says, I give half my belongings to the poor people. If I have defrauded anyone in the least, I will pay them fourfold. This was his true personhood. Jesus saw it, and Jesus called it forth. There are many other stories in the Gospels that we could choose and remember, where people saw a person one way. I'm thinking right now of the woman that came to anoint Jesus. And how can Jesus do that? Does he not know she is a sinner? How can Jesus allow? What is it that Jesus saw in the woman? That was there all along. It isn't as if Zacchaeus all of a sudden, because of his encounter with Jesus, completely changed his personality. Those characteristics have been there all along. But if you've been labeled a cheat, and you've been labeled a sinner, you know, the real personhood can go underground until somebody sees it and calls it forth. Have you ever been in the presence of someone who calls out your own personhood? I never knew what to call it before, but in the last years of my mother's life, I loved going to see her. Just being in her presence was so healing, and she was in a nursing home. Not much stimulation there. But she and I would talk and laugh and just enjoy being with one another. Now I know that it was her true personhood who was calling forth my true personhood. Have you ever met someone in your life who saw beyond your identity and called forth your personhood? Turn to the person next to you in form dyads and take about 2 minutes to think about this and share with the person next to you who this person is or who this person was and the effects their presence has or had on you. If someone does not have a dyad, just form triads. You'll be given about 5 or 10 minutes for this. All right, if you begin to calm down and start coming back to the general, to your seats. I sincerely hope that each one of you were able to recollect a time or a person or an event where your true personhood was called forth. And what was that? And what that was like for you? What happens to us when somebody sees beyond our the scriptures into the depths of who we really are? I overheard someone, and I won't even look in the direction, saying it's like falling in love. And I thought, that says it. That says it. When we are seen in the depths of our being, it is like falling in love. So now maybe we can begin to understand the story of Jesus of Nazareth a little more deeply. Because Jesus was truly a person, because his unbounded spontaneous energy of love radiated outwards as he encountered others. His own deep and profound I am, expressing his Abba oneness, radiates outward toward the other as may you be. This deep relatedness, I am, may you be, is truly a consciousness of interbeing, arising from the very interiority of the beings united. But this is not a relationship that can be mandated, because it is based on intrinsic union and has to be freely accepted. For us to choose to stay on the level of individualism or to desire aloneness defies the interpersonal basis of life. Relationality, hence interbeing, is our most fundamental reality, both on the quantum level of physical life and on the higher levels of conscious human life. But is this how you and I grew up in the United States? Did we grow up being invited to seek relationality as the core of our lives? Or were we not influenced by bringing ourselves up by our own bootstraps? You know, I took a break while writing this to have a cup of tea at home, though. And I was listening as I was having a cup of tea to one of my Christmas gifts. It's a tape from Il Volo, and it was Note Magica. Are you familiar with Il Volo? They are three young tenors. They started singing together at the age of 16 or 17. And at Christmas time, or a little before Christmas, they gathered together in Italy with Placido Domingo directing the symphony. And they reduplicated the concert that the three tenors had done. Some of you saw it. It was on PBS for quite a bit of time. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful concert. Well, I got the tape for Christmas. And right now I'd like you to just sit back and listen to a piece that I think you'll recognize this song. So just sit, listen, and enjoy, and have an imaginary cup of tea.
So I face the final curtain. my friend, I'll say it clear, I'll state my case, of which I am certain. I've lived a life that's full, I traveled each and every highway, and more, much more, I did it my way. Bread, I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I did what I had to do, I saw it through without exemption. I planned each other course, each careful step along the byway, and more, much more than this, I did it my way. Yes, there were times, I'm sure you knew, when I did all that I could show. But through it all, if there were some, I hid up and hid up. I bet you
originally Frank Sinatra, yeah. You stole my thunder. I was going to say, can you think of anyone in our leadership who delights in doing it my way? Oh, he danced that at his inauguration. That makes sense, doesn't it? How awful. So does this reflect an individual? Or does it reflect a person?
An individual.
But it's what we grew up admiring, isn't it? Anne mentioned my training as a liturgical director. When I worked for St. Joseph, this group probably wouldn't be surprised, but do you know some of the biggest fights individuals would get into with the pastor? I can't tell you how many people wanted this song played as the final piece at their funeral. Yeah, interesting, isn't it? And when the pastor would say, no, this is not liturgically correct, blah, 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 they would puff out of their office and come crying to me, and I'd say, well, where we have some liturgical guidelines, liturgical rules, but if it's something that's really meaningful to you, why don't you have it at your reception? And many people did. And so it's reflective of, it's not a put down, it's nothing wrong, it's just reflective of how we grew up praising the individual, picking ourselves up by our own bootstraps. So what I'm inviting us to think about this morning is to move away from that central paradigm and to enter into a different paradigm of relationality. And hopefully, after our break, we'll continue with how does spiritual practice help us to go from one to the other. Because we're not going to be able to do it without spiritual practice. So go enjoy your lunch, and let's come back at, be nice if we could come back at no later than 11:15. Is that a wish on my part? All right, 11:15.
Thank you.
You're welcome.